I'm going to be a little all over the map for a moment. I want to start with a funny story that just occurred to me. I don't know if some of you have heard this story, but I have a colleague in Italy who went home for just to visit family, but he went home at a period when a significant Gemara, which is to say Sicilian Mafia family, was on trial. And one day he's at home just relaxing with his family, and he gets a knock on the door, and to his horror, it's the Don, it's the capo, the Don of the Sicilian mob family. And he very stammeringly invites him in for espresso, pours him some coffee, and they chat for a moment. And finally the Don says to him, you know, this trial, I can't do an Italian accent, but this trial is not going well. I'm probably going to be convicted. So I need you to reach out to your Jewish superiors and see if they can overturn the results. And so Antonio was flabbergasted. And of course, you can't say no to the head of the crime family. So he said, I'm so deeply sorry, Don, but they don't let us into the conspiracy until the second generation, and I'm a convert. So, but I'm happy to pray for you. That's the funny side. Now, the distressing side is that there's been an uptick. I saw an incredible chart of a QAnon conspirator that was shared on Telegram to several hundreds of thousands of persons, of all the Jews who work in media and all of their connections to the Knights Templar and the Illuminati and Major League Baseball. And also quite distressingly this week, Gal Gadot, the Israeli actress and model who appeared as Wonder Woman, made a very, what I thought was very innocuous comment, wishing for peace on both sides and praying for her family's safety in Israel, and was upbraided significantly on the internet. Not only that, but her co-star in the last Wonder Woman movie, Pedro Pascal, merely tweeted that he was excited about the DVD release of the new movie with her, and he was berated on Twitter for that, for sharing in her celebration. Likewise, an enjoyable comic, John Oliver, fell into a trap in his coverage of Israel that really has bothered me more and more. The comparison of death numbers relative to the comparison of missiles fired in the last conflict. Now, just because someone has a bulletproof vest doesn't mean you're allowed to shoot them. And Israel has significant defenses, but there's no excuse for the war crime of indiscriminately launching thousands of missiles at civilian sites. Not to say that both sides don't have guilt and blood on their hands, but the choosing only or choosing to focus on the proportion of deaths on each side is misleading, and it is also not what military proportionality means, which is the proportion of potential civilian casualty to the military value of a target, not the proportion of deaths or violence on both sides. There's no assumption in war that you should pull your punches. And more, I think in the 90s, I was very disdainful of the comment that anti-Zionism was anti-Semitism. And in the 2000s, I sort of returned to the fold of broad and nuanced conversations about Israel. But it seems clear to me that some non-trivial percentage, a plurality, if not the majority, of anti-Zionist talk is also a cover for anti-Semitism. I felt that more strongly this week than ever, and with rising anti-Semitic violence. So that's sort of the context for some of the things I want to share, which is to say, not only that there is blood on both sides' hands, but there is responsibility on both sides' hands to make peace, to endeavor for human rights, to strive for, if not a perfect solution, then an adequate solution to the decades of strife between Jew and Arab, and to the imperfect nature of protecting people's right to exist in the Holy Land and the Middle East and North Africa, to exist in peace, to exist with civil rights, to exist with safety. Great is peace, says our tradition in multiple places. This week, as you saw in the Torah reading that I selected, we read the oath of the Sota, which is a woman who's suspected of infidelity. And it's a really horrible, problematic situation where she is forced to consume a paper that has a words of oath that include God's name on it, and it would dissolve in her stomach and either cause her great distress to unto death, or reveal to her husband that it was a trial by ordeal, that she had not been unfaithful. And my only positive thought about that is that there is such a high unlikelihood that eating a piece of paper with ink on it would cause you intestinal distress, that the most likely outcome is that it proved to her husband that she hadn't been unfaithful. But our sages in Talmud point out that great is peace because we are willing to make peace in a home, and even in so doing, use and blot out God's name, to misuse and take God's name in vain. Among the many values of peace and the many things that it trumps is even the sanctity of God's name. In thinking about the priestly blessing where God grants us shalom, which we often somewhat lazily translate as peace, but also means harmony and the ability to live together, the ability to be whole, I often translate it as completeness, and all of which are prerequisites, I frankly think, for peace. That's why we've come to understand it as peace. The largest corpus of Midrash on Leviticus, the Torat Kohanim, says, if there is no peace, there is nothing. In Mishnah, it says that that is God's greatest gift to us. So I'm going to share with you a few counterintuitive ways we can search for peace. They don't always work, and they require goodwill and good faith on all sides. And I think this is apropos not just of the situation in Israel and Palestine, but also the situation in rural and urban America, the situation in red and blue America, the situation in different zip codes and among different ethnicities and different skin tones. The capacity to build peace that the Sifrei, another major collection of Midrashim on Leviticus, says when it's discussing all the ways in which one is rehabilitated from past transgression. The most common first step, the Sifrei points out, is to admit, to confess, to make accountability. Years ago, during the previous version of this Gaza conflict, which if I recall correctly was 2014, I put something out on Facebook to be my own personal mea culpa for all the pieces of things that I, as a Jew, and I, as a part of a people, have done wrong to the Palestinian people and the previous inhabitants of the land, and the ways in which, given the anti-Semitic traumas of that era and the anti-Semitic traumas of every era, there was no avoiding the Jewish arrival or return to the land after two millennia of desperately praying, but that we had done harm. I hope that would lead to some sort of massive outpouring of mutual apology. It did not. And some of my Muslim friends thought I was just an apologist. They were very grateful for what I said, but not so grateful that they took the steps to acknowledge their own war crimes and inhumanities. So that's not where I hoped it would end. But there is a necessity, regardless to what your neighbor, regardless to what aggrieved party, the other aggrieved party does, for each of us to take stock. You can't make the other person in an argument take stock, because no argument, human or political, is ever one-sided. At best, I find in life, it might be a 90-10 split. But we all share blame on all sides of, and I'm talking about just even in a personal argument between husband and wife, child and parent. We all have to work at it together, rabbi and congregant, for that matter. So we all have to take accountability and admit our own culpability and our own mistakes. As Heschel said, the point of the prophets was not that all are guilty, but that all are responsible. So we move it from the section on the Sota to the section on the Nazir, this ascetic who renounces wine and other blessings. Usually for about a year, and then comes back and makes amends for all that he, I think, or she, I noticed that it could also be a she, which I hadn't noticed, has renounced, that it was not wholly appropriate, but that it was an understandable choice to withdraw and refrain. And in the Haftarah that we did not read, we have the story of Samson, who is himself the most famous of ascetics, the most famous of the Nazarites, with possible exception of the mistranslation of Jesus being a Nazarite. That's why he has long surfer hair in pictures, because they understood him to be a Nazarite, which is to renounce wine and haircuts. So that is a beautiful and fascinating section of our Torah reading. And it goes contrary to this belief we have that Judaism doesn't promote asceticism, or maybe it's the exception that proves the rule. That in general, the Talmud, for example, in Ta'anit, says that when you fast, you are a kind of sinner. However, there is an objection to that opinion, which Rabbi Eliezer in Talmud says, you're termed holy. That in the Torah reading, chapter 6, it speaks of the Nazarite, he shall be holy and let the locks of his hair grow long. And if this person who denied himself wine only, says Rabbi Eliezer, is termed holy, how much more so one who denies oneself the enjoyment over many other things? Refraining is a very powerful spiritual practice, even if it's just not watching YouTube on Shabbat, even if it's just putting one's phone down for a Jewish holiday, even if it's just not taking a third serving of dessert. Refraining is a positive and powerful spiritual practice for all persons, and it is not absent in the Jewish tradition. I mean, I think the most obvious example would be kashrut. The Maimonides says you don't avoid bacon because it's not good. You avoid bacon because your parent in heaven has commanded you not to eat it. Bacon is very good. I remember it from my youth. Still can taste it. I'm glad they've made lamb products that replicate bacon recently, chicken and lamb bacon. Regardless of that, withdrawing and withholding is a kind of going beyond the letter of the law, or as we call it in Hebrew, lifnim mishurat hadin, going within the bounds of the law, which is to say not taking all that you might be contractually deserving of. That's the hard part. I think in Middle East peace and in all kinds of peace, even between husband and wife, I believe it was either Mary Linda's father or Arnold's father who used to say that marriage is a 50-50 proposition, and we often think we're giving 80% when the reality might be that we're giving 20, but the point is always to give 80% on both sides. Give more than you take, give more than you think you can, take less than you want, and only as much as you need seems to be a message. That message of monkishness, though we don't associate it with Judaism, does have its place. But there is a message that I think is also vitally important, and it may be the message that I share the most with you throughout my decade here. The message that Mishnah in Perkei Avot says that don't believe in yourself to the day that you die. And elsewhere in Talmud it says, there is room to repent until the last shovel of dirt. That we are never fully formed, that we are never cooked. Maybe if we live to 120, we could be. But until then, we have so much work to do. And I want to contrast that with something that I really dislike this week that our Midrash says on this parasha. So in a section that we didn't get to, it talks about the role of a Kohen and when he enters service and what his period of apprenticeship could be. And it says that roughly the period of apprenticeship is 5 years. And the Midrash says, from here, it can be inferred that a person who sees no sign of his success in his studies within a period of 5 years should give up. Which, like, you know, my answer to that is this. Like, no way. That's garbage. No way. Don't ever give up. 5 years is nothing. I used to think after I'd been here 5 years, I was very clever as a rabbi. And then about 2 years later, I realized I knew nothing. And then about 2 years later, I looked back after 7 years and thought I knew nothing. I hope that continues forever in my life. And I hope that continues as a parent and as a mathematician and as a reader and as a musician, that we never finish the work. We never become a perfect soccer player. We never become a chess master of masters. There's always more to do. And I think, you know, we can be despairing and despondent of the situation in Israel and Palestine and in the situation of Tennessee and New York. You know, the tensions in our own country among different peoples, different backgrounds, different class, ethnicity, whatever the division might be. Zip code is a very common but overlooked one, right? We can't despair. A friend pointed out in the history, you know, Israel is still a very young country. In America's history, at this point in its life, it still had slavery. So there is time. There is still repair to be done. There is still atonement to be made. There is still admission of guilt on all sides that can be stepped forward with. There was a beautiful story I read, I may have shared with you last week, of a an Israeli who realized that his home had previously been a Palestinian home prior to 48 or 70, 67, and made connection with the landowner and said, I guess I owe you rent. And the landowner said, no, of course not, but I'm glad you acknowledged that it had been my home. That's all I needed was acknowledgement. I don't know that that would be true for every Jew and every Palestinian, but it's a beautiful moment. So in spite of it all, I do think there's possibility for civil rights, for peace, for reconciliation, for unity in our own country and comity in Israel and Palestine and among Jews and Jews and among Jews and Arabs, among Muslims and Christians and Jews in the Holy Land and everywhere. It won't be easy. But the blessing is, well, the priestly blessing is this week. And among the blessings is that God will turn God's face to you. You in the singular, but I would like to read it as you in the plural. That God will turn God's face for you, says the Midrash. For it's not the same thing for a person to greet their neighbor while looking him in the face as to greet the neighbor while turning one's head to the side. That there can be eye contact. There can be face-to-face rapprochement. That there can be intimacy and reconciliation among husband and wife, father and child, Israeli and Palestinian, Jew and Arab, Muslim and Christian. There is a possibility of return, always, always. That is a core message that Judaism teaches me, is that there are always moments of tshuva until the last shovel of dirt.